Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today on our Capitol Report, hear about President Trump's first veto and congressional reactions. Next, we'll have the outcome of Julian's Measure A to dissolve the county's last all-volunteer fire department. Hear about a migration of butterflies through our region and about Governor Newsom's new assignment for the California National Guard. We have a health warning about West Nile virus in Lakeside. Then on Destination East County, hear about festive events in April, from Gold Rush Days to a Western Days parade and more. Lemon Grove's school district is drawing controversy over not renewing contracts for many teachers and some actions that people say are discriminatory. So we will also be re-airing today our interview with Roberto Alvarez on his family's landmark desegregation lawsuit filed against that same school district back in the 1930s. Plus, we'll tell you how you can help KNSJ Radio, which has had to replace its transmitter due to ice storm damage and still needs thousands of dollars in repairs. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
This is Jonathan Getz with the Capitol Report. A courtroom battle looms after President Donald Trump vetoed a resolution passed by both houses of Congress. The congressional resolution rejected Trump's emergency declaration to fund a border wall. The veto came one day after 12 Senate Republicans, in a rare show of bipartisanship, joined with Democrats to pass the resolution which had already been approved by the Democratic-controlled House of Representatives. Congressional members objected to the president issuing his emergency declaration in defiance of Congress, which had earlier voted against Trump's budget request for $5 billion in border wall funding. Trump stated, "Congress has the freedom to pass this resolution, and I have the duty to veto it." He called the resolution reckless and insisted that the immigration system in the U.S. has reached a breaking point. The Constitution gives power of the purse strings to the legislative branch, Congress, not the executive branch of government, which includes the president. Public Citizen, a watchdog group, has filed a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the emergency declaration. The state of California, the American Civil Liberties Union, and others have vowed to also file legal challenges. Legal experts indicate courts will look closely at congressional intent, which clearly was to not fund a border wall at the level sought by Trump. If the executive order survives legal challenges, Trump's plan is to take money from military programs, including some in San Diego, to pay for constructing an international border wall. While many in Congress disagree with the president's assertion that immigration is at an emergency level, even some who share his views on the border wall have voiced concerns that if Trump's emergency declaration stands, future presidents might issue executive orders to divert funds for other projects that Congress has not approved, such as addressing gun violence. It would take two-thirds of both houses of Congress to override the president's veto. Reportedly, there are not enough members in either house willing to support an override. But there is another option to rein in presidential power over emergency declarations. Republican Senator Mike Lee of Utah has introduced a bill that would make it harder for presidents in the future to bypass Congress via an emergency declaration. His plan would require Congress to approve any presidential emergency declaration in the future, or the declaration will automatically terminate after 30 days. Approval would require a simple majority. Currently, an emergency declaration by a president can only be terminated by a congressional resolution sent to the president. That concentrates a large amount of power in a single person, since a president who opts to wield veto power can only be constrained with the two-thirds vote of both the House and Senate. Presidential emergency declarations have been a concern since enactment of the National Emergencies Act of 1976, But now leaders in both parties have suggested it may be time to rein in presidential power. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, normally a staunch supporter of President Trump, states, "If Congress has grown uneasy with this law, as many have, then we should amend it." The veto was the first by President Trump, but likely won't be his last. Trump has threatened to also veto a measure passed by the Senate which cut off U.S. support for Saudi Arabia's coalition forces in the civil war in Yemen, where a humanitarian crisis has been declared by the United Nations. The UN has said that 13 million Yemenis face starvation, including millions of children.
The county's last all-volunteer fire department will soon be history. Measure A, a ballot proposition to dissolve the Julian Cuyamaca Fire Protection District, has passed by a 55% to 45% margin, a difference of only about 128 votes, the Registrar of Voters reports. The measure affirms a decision made last September by the San Diego Local Agency Formation Commission, or LAFCO, to abolish the 35-year-old fire district. Fire and ambulance services will be shifted entirely to the County Fire Authority under direction of CAL FIRE. CAL FIRE Firefighters Union, Local 2881, posted on Facebook, "Thank you to the citizens of Julian and Cuyamaca for the opportunity to serve them." For backers of the Julian Cuyamaca Fire Protection District, who fought hard to keep their volunteer firefighters, however, the outcome sparked strong emotions. Some spoke of legal action, though what that legal cause of action might be has not yet been announced. Dr. Pat Landis says she is really disappointed in the whole process, adding, "Many people voted without really understanding that yes means dissolution." She contends that materials put out by the CAL FIRE Union were misleading. The Julian volunteer firefighters didn't just fight fires and respond to medical calls, they also organized charitable drives and were the glue that held the community together, according to Landis. Once they're gone, she reflects, local control will be gone. The election was mandated after LAFCO received enough protest letters from local residents to overturn its earlier decision to dissolve the district. Dissolution was initially approved by a majority of the Julian Cuyamaca Fire Protection District's Board of Directors due to budget concerns after the county advised it would revoke all funding and the district would have to raise all of its money if voters chose to remain independent. But after several board members resigned, an election last November gave control of the board back to supporters of keeping the district independent. Fundraising efforts have been well underway amid a contentious election in which both sides argued that Julian would be safer if their side prevailed on Measure A. The stakes could not be higher, with lives and property protection on the line. Passage of Measure A means that CAL FIRE will not shut down two stations in the winter months. Ambulance service will continue to be provided by the County Fire Authority, and that's an important point, since loss of a county ambulance would have forced the volunteer district to seek a contract with another ambulance provider, if one could be found, had Measure A not passed. But passage of Measure A also means there will no longer be any local volunteers to respond to calls if CAL FIRE or a county ambulance is not available. Some district supporters have voiced concerns over the potential for future cuts or dark days at stations, as well as delayed responses to local emergencies if CAL FIRE crews are dispatched to battle wildfires somewhere else. Instead of 60 volunteers with CAL FIRE's aid on wildfires, Julian will now be reliant 100% on CAL FIRE, which district backers say means far fewer firefighters on hand to respond to everyday structure fires. Ironically, the Julian Cuyamaca Fire Protection District Chief, Mike Van Bibber, recently recruited dozens of new recruits, 18 of whom recently graduated from the district's training program to become volunteer firefighters. But their hopes, too, have been extinguished with passage of Measure A. Reporting for East County Magazine in Julian, this is Miriam Raftery.
Winter's rains have brought a super bloom season to Southern California, and along with that, butterflies. Millions of orange and black painted lady butterflies are migrating through San Diego County, delighting residents. Chris Collin, a supervising vector ecologist with the County of San Diego, says the butterflies winter in Mexico, then fly north as the weather warms, laying eggs on the flowering plants that are their food sources. Butterflies only live a few weeks, so the next generation will travel to Northern California. Then yet another generation will fly on to Washington and Oregon with future generations of butterflies making the migration southward back to Mexico in the fall. As for the painted ladies winging their way across San Diego County, they won't be here for long. Soon, voracious painted lady caterpillars will hatch out. consuming the flowers such as those blossoming across the Anza Borrego Desert. Colin says, if you like butterflies, enjoy while you can. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Danita Jinks.
Instead of putting up razor wire at the border, California's National Guard troops will soon be wielding shovels, rakes, and chainsaws to clear brush, thin trees, and help prevent the spread of wildfires. The troops will receive 11 days of training in April, then be dispatched across the state in hopes of preventing future disasters, such as the Paradise Fire, which killed over 80 people and destroyed the town of Paradise in Northern California last year. CAL FIRE spokesman Mike Moeller says, there will be boots on the ground doing fuels projects alongside CAL FIRE crews, KNSD reports. It's not the first time the National Guard has been used for fire protection. Thousands of National Guard troops battled fires across the western United States last year, including here in California. Back in 2008, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger called in National Guard troops to help battle hundreds of fires sparked by lightning. Mueller indicated crews would be trained in forest management to avoid overthinning of chaparral and trees. The state estimates that over 23,000 square miles of forests need thinning or restoration, but only 140 square miles of projects are thus far planned. The Forest Service has reported millions of dead trees in California after several years of drought. CAL FIRE is also recruiting civilian fuels management crews to reduce fuels and, if needed, help fight fires in the early stages. But some environmentalists voice concerns. Shea Wood, a scientist with the Center for Biological Diversity, says CAL FIRE is taking the Trump approach, logging the forest and weakening critical environmental protections, and that's the exact opposite of what we need to be doing. Some ecologists say that overthinning of forests and chaparral can lead to increased growth of grasses, which burn hotter and faster, fueling megafires. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the mountains to the sea.
This is Danita Jinks with a health alert. County health officials are warning that a dead Cooper's hawk in Lakeside has tested positive for the West Nile virus, the first sign of a potentially deadly disease this year in San Diego region. Mosquitoes can transmit West Nile virus and other diseases by biting an infected bird then biting a person. Symptoms of West Nile virus includes headache, fever, nausea, rash, and swollen glands. Usually these are mild, but the disease can be fatal. Last year, 215 Californians became infected with the West Nile virus and 10 people died. Residents are urged to dump out any standing water in your yard that mosquitoes can breed in after the recent heavy rains. This includes rain gutters, plant saucers, buckets, tires, toys, old tires, and wheelbarrows. If you have a pond, fountain, or unseated swimming pool, you can get free mosquito fish from the county vector control. You can protect yourself from mosquitoes by wearing long sleeves and pants or using insect repellent containing dipyrrolidine, lemon eucalyptus, or IR3535. Be sure that screens on your windows and doors are in good condition to keep mosquitoes out. Protecting against mosquitoes has become even more important for the San Diego County residents in recent years. Since 2014, three types of day-biting invasive Aedes mosquitoes have been found in San Diego County. These invasive mosquitoes can breed in yards or even inside homes in as little as a thimble full of water. All of them can potentially transmit diseases not naturally found here, but only if they first bite an infected person, such as a returning traveler. Residents are asked to report any dead birds, increased mosquito activity, and green neglected pools to the county's vector control program at 858-694-2888. Also report if you are bitten by a mosquito during daylight hours or suspect you have found Aedes mosquitoes.
Welcome to Destination East County with your hosts, Valerie Watts
and Jonathan Getz.
bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week.
April brings springtime activities galore to East County. This week's Destination East County includes Julian Gold Rush Days, Meet the Winemaker Weekend, the Catfish Opener at Santee Lakes, a star party at Mission Trails, and a spring extravaganza with egg hunts galore.
Plus, we'll have a preview of coming attractions, including Cajon Classic Cruise celebrating its centennial season, Spring Harp Fest in La Mesa, and a Spring Garden and Butterfly Festival at the Water Conservation Garden.
Plus, hear about Lakeside's Rodeo and Western Days Parade coming up and a Warbirds Expo at Gillespie Field.
So stay tuned for all of these events and many more.
The Julian Gold Rush Days Festival will take place April 6th and 7th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. You can try your hand at gold panning, tomahawk throwing, candle making, archery, arts and crafts, hay rides, and more at the Julian Farm. Or visit the Eagle Peak Mine and Museum to experience the life of a gold miner, including a tour inside the mine. Julian's Doves and Desperados will perform a skit at 2 p.m. in front of the Julian Jail. You can also try some apple pie, the town's new gold drawing tourists from around the world. For tickets and details, visit juliangoldrushdays.com.
April 6th and 7th is also Meet the Winemakers Weekend in Ramona. Participants can enjoy VIP tours at up to 6 wineries, plus dinner by Something Delicious Catering at Reds, Whites, and Brews, located in the heart of historic downtown Ramona, where you'll mingle with local winemakers. The two-day event also includes a continental breakfast at Ramona Naturals and snacks by Cheeses from the Cave, plus a souvenir wine glass. For tickets, you can visit RamonaValleyVineyards.com.
The Catfish Opener at Santee Lakes is set for Saturday and Sunday, April 6th and 7th. 2,000 pounds of catfish will be stocked for fishing. Plus, there will be tagged fish that you can redeem for prizes, as well as prizes for the 5 biggest catfish caught. For details, you can visit SanteeLakes.com.
Air Group 1, the San Diego wing of the Commemorative Air Force, will host a Warbird Expo and World War II Collectors Swap Meet at Gillespie Field in El Cajon on Saturday, April 13th from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. Tickets for a ride in a real World War II airplane can also be purchased online or at the event. This is the largest fundraiser of the year for Air Group 1 to help keep these historic World War II aircraft flying and fund youth education programs on careers in aviation. Displays will feature World War II and classic aircraft, vintage and classic cars, and local vendors. The World War II memorabilia swap meet section will have unique artifacts and collectibles, including books, photos, toys, uniforms, and insignias. For additional information, you can visit the Air Group 1 Commemorative Air Force website at ag1caf.org.
You're invited to a star party at Mission Trails Regional Park on April 13th from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. Amateur astronomer George Vargas will bring his telescope to the far end of the Kumeyaay Lake Campground's day-use lot. You'll have opportunities to view galaxies, stars, and constellations. For more information, you can visit mtrp.org.
Santee Lakes is hosting its Spring Eggstravaganza with fun for the whole family on Sunday, April 14th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Children can enjoy continuous egg hunts, pony rides, a petting zoo, carnival rides, crafts, foods, and photos with bunnies. Details are available at SanteeLakes.com.
Celebrating 100 years of cruising, Cajon Classic Cruise opens its centennial season on April 17th. You're invited to view the classic cars along Main Street and Prescott Promenade each Wednesday evening from 5 to 8 p.m. in downtown El Cajon. A full season lineup of activities will be posted soon at downtownelcajon.com.
Harmonicas will be wailing at the 20th Annual Spring Harp Fest in La Mesa's Harry Griffin Park on Saturday, April 20th from 11 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. This festival was founded to promote blues harmonica music, an American art form. Donations at the event are used to fund youth music programs with harmonicas and a summer blues camp. For a full list of performers and details, visit springharpfest.org.
The Water Conservation Garden at Cuyamaca College in Rancho San Diego invites you to its annual Spring Garden and Butterfly Festival on April 27th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Visitors can watch butterfly releases and enjoy a butterfly pavilion. There will also be plant sales, tours, crafts, vendors, story time with Miss Metamorphosis, and the Ms. Smarty Plants Pollinator Party. For full details, you can visit springgardenfestival.com.
Yeehaw! The Lakeside Rodeo on April 26th through 28th will showcase cowboy and cowgirl skills in competitions that include bareback riding, team roping, bull riding, barrel racing, saddle bronc riding, steer wrestling, and more. You can find tickets and details at lakesiderodeo.com. Now, the rodeo is all part of Lakeside's Western Days, which also includes the annual Lakeside Western Days Parade on April 27th from 9:30 a.m. to noon through historic downtown Lakeside. This parade features equestrians, floats, bands, clowns, color guards, and drill teams, local dignitaries, and more. You can find details at lakesidechamber.org.
That's all for this week. You can find details on all of these events and more in the calendar and events section at our website, eastcountymagazine.org.
If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you would like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website, or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around East County!
This is Jonathan Getz with an education report in Lemon Grove. The Lemon Grove School District Board of Directors faced an overflow crowd at its March meeting, where parents, students, teachers, and community members shared united concerns over what some called the forced resignations of 16 teachers. The district released a statement claiming misinformation had been shared, which suggested teachers were targeted for using sick days or speaking out on behalf of students. The district denied this, but confirmed that some probationary teachers were notified of recommendations for their release. These are not layoffs due to smaller class sizes or budget concerns, since all 16 positions will be filled in the next school year, according to Board President Katie Dexter. Pierre Finney, president of the Lemon Grove Teachers Association, made clear that the district has a right to not renew contracts of probationary teachers and doesn't have to give a reason. But he said that the high number, 16, is unusual. Over the past decade, the number has typically ranged from 0 to 3. Finney explained the teachers were notified and given a courtesy option to resign rather than received a non-reelect on the record. He objected to the district giving teachers only 2 days to make a decision on whether to resign or not. Before the meeting, Lemon Grove California School Employees Association representative Denise Crano said the district had gone through upheaval with a new superintendent, assistant superintendent, and director of general services in the past 2 years. Transparency is gone, Crano said, adding that morale is down among parents and students. She said, "Teachers already know our kids, and if you take them away, then you're starting from scratch." Rose Carney, a parent and member of the English Learner Advocacy Committee, said the dual language program's curriculum contained many errors in Spanish content, and that key committees were not given the opportunity to review materials before purchase. She added that policies requiring parents to show ID on campus was making some undocumented parents afraid to come to their children's school to meet with teachers. Carney laments, "Before the new administration, we had a community. We could communicate freely." Board President Timothy Shaw tried to limit speaking times during public comments to 20 minutes per agenda item, despite over 100 people in attendance and over 20 speaker slips submitted. Each speaker was given 3 minutes to speak, meaning only 7 people would be able to speak per item. After multiple interruptions from the audience and a plea from school board member Jay Bass, every person who timely submitted a speaker card was allowed to speak. Paula Hoffman, a concerned community member, reminded the audience that Lemon Grove was famous for 1930s illegal school segregation, a reference to a landmark desegregation lawsuit that protected the rights of Mexican-American children in Lemon Grove. Hoffman reminded the audience of a time when ESL students were being bused to a different school district. She claimed the current inequities were clear Williams Act violations. Hoffman asserted that teachers who have complained are being fired. To her, the school district has demonstrated cronyism and nepotism, as well as spending funds to remodel the new superintendent's office. Pandora Menegas emphasized that the best teachers speak up for children, even if it's during their probationary period. Emma Contreras, an 8th grade student at Mount Vernon, shed tears as she testified, crying in frustration over losing her teacher and having substitute teachers for a month and a half. Yusuf Miller shared support for the 16 teachers who he said are beloved by the community. Miller emphasized that even the appearance of retaliation and a hostile environment would adversely impact the district. He suggested that the district was sending students the wrong message by targeting teachers who have stood up for justice. Elia Alcantara has been a longtime volunteer with the district and spoke in Spanish, with the translator providing what audience members called inaccurate translation services. Alcantara stressed that since the arrival of Superintendent Kimberly Berman and Assistant Superintendents Yolanda Rogers and Eddie Caballero, the schools have changed for the worse, with limited resources, even rationing how many Kleenex tissues children can use. A 9-year-old student said he was diagnosed with ADHD. He told the board, "I don't think my math teacher should be replaced because she's really patient." Sean Parmalee, a San Diego teacher who made headlines in 2017 for videos recording her refusal to answer citizenship questions at a Border Patrol checkpoint, noted that 6 sheriff's deputies were called to the school board meeting with guns, batons, and pepper spray. Parmalee said this is what they do when they are afraid of you and want to silence you. She suggested that the board bringing in deputies might intimidate parents and others with undocumented immigrant status. Parmalee said targeting 16 teachers sounds like a group non-reelect, which is against the code and also sounds like retaliation. Liana LeBaron passed out notices from a group called Lemon Grove Parents United. LeBaron testified that the school district went from great to absolute junk. She criticized what she claimed were district efforts to silence teachers and parents. She also alleges that teachers were told to tell parents that their presence at the board meeting is not required. Mark Lane, a parent with children at Mount Vernon Elementary School, promised to run campaigns to unseat 4 of the 5 school board members. Some other parents and community members who spoke called for replacing the superintendent and assistant superintendents. Despite the controversy over 15 teachers who had submitted resignation notices prior to the board meeting, not a single board member requested any board discussion on the matter, which was approved as part of the consent item agenda, normally reserved for non-controversial matters. The vote was 3-2. The board also unanimously agreed to accept the resignation of a 16th teacher submitted after the agenda was published. Board President Katie Dexter then introduced a motion to raise board members' salaries by 5%, but failed to receive a second to her motion.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
Now, after that story on controversies in the Lemon Grove School District with racial overtones, we thought it would be a good time to replay our interview with Roberto Alvarez on the troubling history in this district and a landmark desegregation case filed way back in the 1930s by his family.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. Guest hosting today our Sounds of History segment on the East County Magazine Show. My very special guest today is Roberto Alvarez. Roberto is a professor emeritus of ethnic studies at the University of California, San Diego, and he's here today to talk to us about some amazing things that he found out while researching his own family history and discovering their role in what's become known as the Lemon Grove Incident. Roberto, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Tell us a little bit about your own family background, for starters, when your grandparents came to this country.
My grandparents, along with many of the community of Lemon Grove, migrated from Baja California. And it took a long time, you know, a period of, you know, decades to move through a mining district into California. And they crossed the border around 1900, the early decades of the 1900s.
Mm-hmm. So their children were born here. They were all citizens here when the 1930s rolled around. Tell us, when you were doing your college dissertation on immigration, what you found out.
Well, I decided to do my PhD dissertation, and it is in anthropology, on immigration, because there was very little being written at the time. on immigration from a humanitarian and anthropological perspective. Most of the work had been done on economics, on the economic push-pull of the larger forces of immigration.
Yeah, so there were no human stories.
No, there were not. There were very few. There were some very early ones in the 1920s that were done. But my reaction was that what I was reading in the literature did not reflect my own background or the background of my family. So I decided to do my dissertation on immigration and do a social history of the migration of my own family into California. During that time, when I began doing the dissertation, I interviewed people who I thought I knew, but these were people that had incredibly full and rich backgrounds that I didn't know about. And I learned of more of the connections of the family within San Diego County and also across the border. In that interviewing, I discovered that people spoke about the school case. And this is something that I had never heard about or any of my generation had really heard about either. And when I asked my father, what is this school case thing? He said, well, it was a case that occurred in segregation, Lemon Grove.
And this was a case that overturned the segregation of a Lemon Grove school. And it turns out that your father, who is also named Roberto Alvarez, was just 9 years old at the time. And it was your grandparents who were among the plaintiffs that filed this landmark case.
That's correct. The community was very unified. And part of this was because they all had known each other through the migration trail. When they got to Lemon Grove, they lived in one section of town. And when they learned of the segregation, they formed what they called the Asociación de Vecinos de Lemon Grove, the Lemon Grove Neighborhood Association, and basically took the case to court.
Basically what happened was these children at one time were in the main school in Lemon Grove. Along came a school board that voted to move all the Mexican-American children, even citizens, into a separate school, a segregated school. This in an era 20 years before the Brown versus Board of Education case in the U.S. Supreme Court in the 1950s eventually overturned segregation nationwide. In that case, it was a school for African-American children. Quite a historic action.
It is. It's interesting that the principal, Jerome Green, was not in favor of the segregation. It was a school board.
So tell us how the parents reacted when the school board built this separate school.
The parents learned about the upcoming segregation. There was a school being built. They called it a school, a building in the Mexican area that was being built specifically for the Mexican American kids, which they called La Caballeriza, which means the barn.
The barn.
Or the barn or the barnyard. They were incensed, basically, that their children, who they felt deserved to be with other American citizens in the regular school, should be put in a different school. So Juan Gonzalez was also very principal in this, in addition to all the families. But Juan Gonzalez had some dealings with a lawyer in Sonora, I believe it was, who helped with the case. The association got together, and they went to the Mexican consul and asked for support. And the support that they received from the consul is kind of tenuous because Mexico can't get involved in U.S. affairs. But it was Fred Noon was the name of the lawyer. Fred Noon took on the case. So anyway, they were very adamant about what they were going to be doing.
And while the lawsuit was working its way through the court, the parents didn't just stand by idly doing nothing. I understand your grandmother was instrumental in this, but they actually pulled their kids out of the school, I understand, and went on strike. Had the kids go on strike?
Well, what happened was they chose I think it was the day after Christmas vacation to separate the kids and take them over to the new school, the Mexican kids. And the principal stood at the door and separated the kids, the Mexican kids from the Anglo kids. And the story is that when he went into the school to place the Anglo kids, the Mexican kids just came home and they were instructed by their parents not to go to the other school. That's what began the strike. It lasted for several months, I believe.
So they really stood up and took a stand.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Very inspiring. This should be put against the historical backdrop of the times. This was not an isolated case. Tell us a little bit about the historical context of segregation in the era, as well as the anti-immigrant actions that were taking place across America during the 1930s, which was, of course, the Great Depression.
That's really a very important question. And you need to remember that the there are some parallels here with what's going on today.
Definitely.
You know, there was a very strong anti-immigrant sense in the country, that the Depression was basically forcing great competition for jobs, of course, and it threatened the larger population. Mexican immigrants were seen as troublemakers, health problems.
Sounds a lot like a Donald Trump speech, doesn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. Yeah. In fact, what happened was that there were almost 500,000 Mexican and Mexican-Americans deported.
Yeah, whole families, I understand.
Families, they were rounded up in Los Angeles in the parks. It was the Hoover administration that initiated that deportation.
Yeah, basically the Donald Trump plan brought to reality way back in the 1930s.
I guess you could say that, but what happened was that during that period of time, there was a tremendous anti-Mexican sentiment. There was a governor's report that came out in 1930 that basically it was called Mexicans in California. It didn't say anything of Mexican Americans or citizens. Everybody was lumped, whether they were citizens or not, as people of Mexican origin.
Yeah.
So that the problem became one of all people of Mexican origin, not just immigrants. So that the people that were deported, and there were people from Lemon Grove that were actually deported who were citizens,
citizens
during that period of time into Mexico. So it's sort of like the Trump thing. And what's frightening, however, is that
almost worse in a sense, because they even deported citizens back.
Well, they
then.
Did deport yeah. citizens, but it's that same mentality.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and the mentality itself really isn't new. It's gone on for hundreds of years, unfortunately. When the Irish were coming over to work the railroads, or the Chinese,
absolutely.
You know, there was anti-immigrant sentiment against them, the Japanese during World War II. Why do you think it is that it seems like whenever times are hard, we also seem to see this rise in anti-immigrant sentiment against whichever group is, you know, has the influx of population at the time?
Well, I believe it's like what I mentioned before, it's really a threat to the so-called majority, and it's basically the white majority. You know, people, the same arguments were being made in the 1930s, the same arguments were yeah. made with the Chinese Exclusion Act, etc. You know, they're taking our jobs, they have health problems, they cause troubles, they're criminals, etc., etc. And it's a threat to the ideology of America, you know, that these people who are not really American are you know, causing all these problems and issues.
Yeah. And yet almost all of us, unless we're Native American, are descended from immigrants somewhere down the chain. Back to the case in the 1930s. So this moved forward to the courts. The kids went out on strike. They were out for what, 6 months? And your father was one of those?
It was, I believe it was about 6 months.
Yeah. And your dad was how old at the time?
He was nine.
Nine years old.
Nine years old, right.
What an ordeal for a young child at the time.
You know, I'd like to return to the historical context.
Yes.
Because in addition to being in the Depression period, you know, this was a time when segregation throughout the country was pretty rampant. You know, we have the Jim Crow law, right?
Yeah.
Separate but equal. But this was occurring throughout the Southwest as well. I think that the Lemon Grove school case was one of a good example of that.
I'm curious, given all of these Jim Crow laws, and this was not the only school in California that was segregating out Mexican-American children. There had even been some court cases that backed up the discrimination. What made your grandparents and the other parents that decided to go forward with this case do so? What made them believe they could win?
That's really a good question. I think they just had a lot of integrity. Mm-hmm. And they really, they knew where they were. They knew who their children were. They knew that they were citizens and had rights as citizens in this country.
Yeah, so very courageous action. So ultimately, tell us which court made the decision and what it was.
It was the court here in San Diego, the Superior Court of San Diego County. The decision was that it was indeed a case of segregation. Interestingly, during this period, which again illustrates sort of the long haul of Jim Crow, it was illegal to segregate white children. And at the time, Mexican Americans were considered white.
Interesting.
So that I've heard arguments that, well, they won because they were white. But it goes back to your earlier question that, you know, it took a lot of guts and stamina for those parents to stand up against a school board, given the time that they were in.
And we should note that not every white person in Lemon Grove supported what the school board was doing. In fact, the principal, you've told me, opposed it.
Not at all. In fact, my father said that most of the families were against this kind of a segregated move. It was mainly the school board for personal reasons that was really pushing this.
Yeah, some of the comments seemed very racist as the true motivation, but it was interesting because ostensibly in court, the school district tried to argue that this was really in the best interest of the Mexican-American kids because they didn't speak English and they were going to get more help in this school, which was really a shack we're putting them into, and that keeping them in the main school would slow down the progress of the white kids. And the judge did a pretty interesting, pretty effective job of tearing apart those arguments. He asked them, what do you do when you have a slow learner that's a white kid? And of course, they don't segregate them out and send them off to their own school. And so he concluded that, in fact, this was racist and segregation. And he ordered the school to be desegregated 20-something years before the landmark Brown versus Board of Education case.
That's right. What's really interesting, however, is that when they went back to the school, they went back to the Mexican classes. You know, I interviewed people who graduated 10 years later from that school who were still talked about being in the Mexican classes. There were a few people like my dad who spoke very good English, and I think Jesse Gonzalez and a few other folks that were placed with the white kids because they spoke English well, and they were light-complected. So anyway, what I'm getting at is there was still a segregation going on in the school. They were separated, which you can't do today, obviously.
Yeah, it didn't.
The case ended the separation of the children from one school to another school.
But not within the classroom.
In a legal you know, sense.
Very.
But when they went back to school, to the regular school, they were back in separated classes.
And for those listeners that may be wondering, why did it take 20-something years for the Supreme Court to strike down segregated schools? It's because the Lemon Grove School Board decided not to file an appeal, so there never was a precedent set that would apply anywhere else. Why do you think they didn't appeal?
Well, apparently, from the research that we've done, they spent a lot of money building the school.
They just couldn't afford it.
They couldn't afford it, and I think that there was maybe one or two people on the school board that were very adamant about pursuing this.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the board felt that it was no longer necessary, that it was, and they lost and they should just leave it, let it go.
Now, your family is a true American success story. Your grandparents, as we've mentioned, came here. They picked fruit in the early days in Lemon Grove with all of the orchards and the packing houses that Lemon Grove was known for in those days. And then your father, that 9-year-old boy who was at the center of this firestorm of a case, what did he go on to do when he got done with his schooling?
He was considered one of the hardworking kids around. And he worked for the Stonker brothers, I know that, and got into the grocery business that way. And he joined the Navy and learned bookkeeping in the Navy during the Second World War. And when he returned, he and a cousin, Henry Castellanos, another family that was involved in the school case, went in partners and formed a produce company that became very, very successful and still running today. It's a very successful adventure. He was a very eclectic individual, did a lot of work in Mexico, ended up doing a lot of work throughout the southwestern United States.
I think this is a common story among immigrants where the first generation maybe is laborers, fruit pickers in this case. The son goes on to start a business, serve in the military, run his own produce company, and then the grandson now, you, are a college professor. So quite the success story there. Tell us what happened to some of the other kids that came out of that school and this case.
Well, there were, from that generation, I don't think anyone, there was only a few people, my father and a few others that went to high school, finished high school.
Yeah.
The Depression came along and hit pretty hard, and many of the young men went into the Civilian Conservation Corps.
Mm-hmm.
My uncle,
our country.
Sure, is a good example of that. So most of that generation did not go on to school. They were successful in terms of being, you know, living in the United States and becoming part of the mainstream, pretty much. There was always, even when I was growing up, there was always some discrimination and so on. But that even occurs today.
Yeah.
So, but you know, I do want to go back to you mentioned that spread of time between Lemon Grove and Brown versus the board.
Yes.
One of the things that I've come to realize is that when I first learned about the Lemon Grove case, it was an event that none of us knew about in my generation. My parents' generation never even talked about it.
Why do you think that is? Why was it not a story that was passed down through the family, do you believe?
There are two reasons. One, I think, is that my father used to say that it was the parents that did this. It was his parents and the community that was struggled and did this and stood up. They just followed their parents' orders. They did whatever their parents told them to do. They went to court, they went to school, and so on. retrospectively, I think that he was able to, when we were doing this work, when I actually was doing the research on the school, he took great pride in it and began to speak about it, as well as other people
in
the community.
Yeah, so you went back and talked to him about it when you came.
Oh, absolutely.
In.
And we interviewed him. There was a film made. There was a number of things that highlighted the case and made it public.
And we should note that for these efforts that you made to bring this incident to light, you have recently been honored and named a living legend by the San Diego County Library as part of their series honoring citizens here in San Diego County who have done some amazing things in their lifetimes. So congratulations on that.
Thank you very much. I was humbled by that, and I think it really reflects on the, not just on my father, but on the community that I came out of. I think that endeavor to stand up for your rights, stuck with us.
Absolutely. You've mentioned that you have another friend who recently went on to achieve some great honors. Tell us about that. Another young immigrant of this generation.
I just returned from this last week in Washington, D.C. I went to the Library of Congress because a very close friend, a very intimate friend, Juan Felipe Herrera, was named the Poet Laureate of the United States.
Very good.
He was a son of migrant workers, was born in Fowler, but he spent much time here in San Diego in Logan Heights. He was another individual who struggled and got to school and made it through postgraduate work and became a professor at University of California, Riverside. He was a distinguished professor there. So there are a few of us, but I think that we're the exception. There still needs to be a lot more of us and a lot more exposure about the kinds of work that people like Juan Felipe are doing.
You know, you mentioned exposure. Do you believe that the shifts we've seen in recent years in media toward media outlets where people are tending to sort of self-select media that goes along with their own mindset. In some cases, is that reaffirming prejudices that people have? Are you concerned about a rise in media that does not attempt to follow the fairness doctrine to show all voices or viewpoints that tend to be skewed toward one particular point of view?
I think the media is certainly skewed. All the media to a certain extent. And obviously people listen to what they want to listen to and they like to have their own ideas.
Yeah, and we hear overt hate speech on some of the talk radio in particular.
Well, you can see the sentiment now with Trump, the folks that have that sentiment is being expressed through Donald Trump. But I also think that there's a certain responsibility that we have as individuals and citizens to find out what those differences really are. And I think that comes through our educational system, through being aware of what's going on around us. We seem to focus on those things that suit our own interests rather than branching out a little bit. And I think it really has a lot to do with being able to discern and being educated about what's going on around us so that we can make decisions that are much more logical instead of just...
So you see the educational system as the answer. What about an increase in alternative media outlets such as internet media?
Absolutely.
As well as stations
like
KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, which is a public educational station.
Obviously, it's the more news that we have, it's just better for people to hear these different things. But the point is, however, that today, everywhere you go, you're looking at a phone. I took a hike in Joshua Tree National Monument when it was this big, long hike. And I get to the top, and everybody has a cell phone.
They do. The kids are all connected.
I mean, there's 20 people up there. Every one of them has a cell phone, and they're connected to whatever it is that they're connected to.
Oh, well, social media is huge now. You look at Twitter. It started a revolution practically over
the years. But it almost annihilates the actual place that they're in, the actual situation that they find themselves in.
So there's power in that, though. There can be. I mean, it can be a distraction if you're out hiking and ignoring nature, but there's also power
absolutely,
in the ability to
there's
network,
power.
Right?
Absolutely. If you look at how the Middle East arose with Twitter and the fast, the media and so on. If you look at what happened with the Zapatistas, it was all about the media and reaching out across the world, not just in Mexico or the United States. It was about connecting to that larger media to have something change.
So what message would you send to listeners out there who may be concerned about the parallels that we're seeing today in the national mindset among many people toward immigrants that we also saw back in the 1930s when this Lemon Grove desegregation case occurred?
The first thing is that we have to recognize, as in Lemon Grove, it was a minority, a very small minority of individuals who were pushing this idea of segregation and this sort of hate and anti-immigrant sentiment. It's similar today. It's a minority of individuals who have a lot of voice. For the others, people who are out there, and that's most of us, I believe, it's important to know what the facts are. For instance, today, in the entire history of our country, there's less immigration coming across that border than there ever was.
Very true.
And so, but we still hear the idea of building two fences and so on and so forth.
Even though, immigration is already down.
Even though it's not that adamant. It's really not that severe as people are claiming.
Right, because immigration is down substantially.
It's down substantially. And then you need to look at the contributions that immigrants are making here in this country.
Roberto, you've talked about there being a thread or a stream of cases involving segregation, that Lemon Grove was far from an isolated instance. Tell us about that.
When I first found out about Lemon Grove, because I hadn't known about it, nor my generation had known about it, nor had my parents talked about it, it seemed like an isolated event. So we called it the Lemon Grove Incident. Over the years, however, I've realized that there have been other cases that are tied together over the years. And if you look at it as a larger movement of segregation that ties both black and brown and red and others into
the
stream.
Yeah, we had this was an era when we had Native American children being sent off to Indian schools, boarding schools, and black children in all black schools in the South.
Absolutely. So that if you think about it in the long durée, the long stream of history, it begins really in 1850 with Roberts and a case against the Boston School Board, which resulted in Plessy versus Ferguson, which basically resulted in the Jim Crow law, separate but equal.
Yeah.
Well, Jim Crow was also Jose Crow, because throughout the Southwest, Mexicans were also separated exactly as black folks were in the South.
How common were these types of segregated schools in California and the Southwest in that era?
Well, they were very, very common. There were two cases prior to the Lemon Grove case, one in Del Rio, Texas in 1930. There was a 1929 case in Tempe, Arizona that was based on also on segregation.
How did they turn out?
They apparently won. The communities won, but they were overturned in courts afterwards.
And that was appellate courts, but none of them went all the way to the U.S.
Supreme
Court.
None of them went to the U.S. Supreme Court. But after, and remember, these are immigrant communities who are pretty much in contact.
Yeah, so people were standing up for their rights.
They were standing up for their rights, and I think this is something that was that we forget about, that there was communication, that people are moving back and forth. We talk about migrants who are moving through these periods, and we never talk about the fact that they're communicating, that they're actually telling people what's going on.
Yeah, there was a national media, a Mexican newspaper at the time, I understand, that was covering the Lemon Grove case and getting support for it, financial support and so forth from all over the country.
That's correct. The La Opinion in Los Angeles. There were letters written to La Opinion from the Lemon Grove school, from the Lemon Grove community, asking for support. 9 years after, in Orange County, California, the Mendez versus Westminster case, and 9 years is not that long, considering the fact that you do have media, you have people moving and so on.
Yeah, and this is before the internet, social media, so it took a while for the word to get around.
But the Mendez case was instrumental, and this is a case of Mexican Americans and segregation. It was instrumental in the Brown versus the Board case.
Really?
During that case, Earl Warren, who was the governor of the state of California, ultimately signed segregation, made it illegal, you know, in California.
Oh, interesting. But, and Earl Warren, of course, so he signed the anti-segregation law here, and he went on to become a very influential justice on the Supreme Court.
He was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court during the Brown versus the Board case. Similarly, there were a number of amicus briefs written. These are supports for the plaintiffs, a Jewish American League, the Japanese American League, and a variety of others. And what was included there was also the NAACP.
Do you think these other cases, the other case in California that you just cited, was that influenced at all by the Lemon Grove case? I know it wasn't a legal precedent, but were people connected? Were they hearing what was going on down here? Do you think what happened here maybe inspired people to challenge these laws in other places?
You know, I strongly believe that it was that it was influential.
So the desegregation that started right here in Lemon Grove in San Diego's East County was influential in ultimately helping to overturn segregated schools nationwide through the Brown versus Board of Education case.
In a sense, it was. That's why I emphasize the fact that segregation was going on for a very long time, that it happened in the South. Thurgood Marshall worked with the Texas educators in the 1940s to end segregation in Texas. There was a lot of communication between educators in Texas and Thurgood Marshall at the time.
Mm-hmm. Who became a Supreme Court justice also.
Right.
So Thurgood Marshall was working to end segregation.
Absolutely. The point I'm trying to make is that in the Mendez case, he wrote an amicus brief that basically outlined several of the arguments that were made in the Brown versus the Board that he used in the Brown versus the Board case based on the, you know, constitutional rights of children in the United States to end segregation. So ultimately, Earl Warren from California and Thurgood Marshall, who wrote that amicus brief, sat, you know, in the Supreme Court of the United States and argued, which ended up finally ending segregation in the country. The argument is that the stream of these small cases were not isolated, they were connected, and it was a larger segregation movement that included black and brown folks.
Very good. Listeners, we've been speaking with Roberto Alvarez about his family's role in a landmark case that desegregated the Lemon Grove School back in the 1930s. I want to give you the final words today, Roberto. Thank you so much for joining us. What can people who are concerned about the immigrant bashing that we're seeing today do about it?
Everybody needs to take a stand, basically. Everybody needs to stand up for what's right. And that can be done in a number of ways. It can be done just by voting. But at the same time, we have to recognize that there is this issue and that we all need to get political. Basically, to get active, to do something about what's going on. It's one thing to understand and see what's going on, but there's something else in actually taking action and doing something.
To stand up and speak out, just like your grandparents did and all of the other parents and children back in the 1930s who helped to desegregate a school right here in Lemon Grove in San Diego's East County.
That's correct. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Roberto. It's been an honor. Thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you very much, and it's been an honor to represent community, to represent Lemon Grove, and to be able to say a few words about how important it is to be active, to be concerned with social justice. Thank you.
Imagine trying to meet the challenges of this rapidly changing world without independent media bringing fresh perspective and uncensored news to the people. This is the context in which we make this plea for help from your community radio station. We served, and now we need you and your support to continue our mission, bringing social justice and independent media to the Southern California airways. San Diego needs KNSJ 89.1 FM back on the air. Ironically, KNSJ fell victim to global climate disruption and the worst ice storm in decades, which damaged the antenna and took San Diego's only community radio station off the air. KNSJ 89.1 FM announced that this people-powered radio station will be depending on a people-powered fundraising campaign to raise $4,000 to $8,000 to complete the necessary repairs and technically protect itself against future disruptions. Go to knsj.org and press the donate button now.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.